Hello, and welcome to Towards the Point, a cultural compass for Pompey and beyond. I'm James Sandy, and ripping through the hull of our good ship tonight, we get artistically wrapped up in a bit of transformism. We consider the Jazz Age and the genre's ever-popular retelling on the small screen, and we review the new album from Mancunian underdogs, I Am Clute. Holding me tight to the mast, as ever, are our two salty sea dogs, Dave Allen and Simon Mobbs. Welcome, folks. Now, we've got lots to get through. All of the things we're going to mention tonight you can find on our blog, which is towardsthepoint.blogspot.com, and you can also find a show archive on there, podcasts of previous programmes. But we're going to start tonight with art. And Simon, you've been looking at transformism. Another ism.
Indeed. Transformism is an art show commissioned by an organisation called the Arts Catalyst, which is a cross-disciplinary organisation merging science and art together. It features the work of Melanie Jackson and Revital Cohen, and it's taking place at the John Hansard Gallery at the moment. To give you a little bit of an idea, the blurb from the actual brochure suggests that this exhibition will reflect on our compulsion to alter and to shape the materials, objects and living entities around us, to contemplate our relationships with biology and matter as they are radically transformed by human agency.
Now that's massive, isn't it? As a description, as a kind of target aim. Now I kind of interpret that, because obviously, you know, I'm a cultured soul, as nature crashing into technology.
Yeah.
Are we somewhere around that?
Yeah, absolutely. If you take on like the idea that you get all sorts of strange kind of hybrids and things happening with nature now, so scientists can produce bananas that have their own vaccines, fluorescent cats, trees that can clean up pollution, nanorobots that can enter human cells, you know, that kind of stuff.
Your regular, everyday craziness.
Yeah, you pick it up from B&Q.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But that's the kind of starting point it's taken, that there's an amazing kind of set of developments happening with the world of biology and science, and art should maybe reflect that.
And it's looking at the natural world, and animals in particular, I think, as products. Is that right?
Indeed. In particular, the work of Revital Cohen, and she has two pieces of there, one of which is a documentary called King Yo Kingdom. It's 20 minutes long, and I find it a very morally challenging documentary, but also quite calm and quite handsome. So I kind of had a very dual experience with it. What it centres on is the idea of these designer animals, which are called Ranchu fish, which are fishes which are aesthetically bred just for beauty.
Okay, so they're purposely engineered to look nice.
Exactly, yeah. And they go back in cultural history to the Edo period in Japan. So what the documentary does is it doesn't really kind of say this is wrong or this is right. It takes a neutral stance but looks at the kind of culture of this. So it looks at the personal motivations of the goldfish breeders themselves. And they vary from, say, retired businessmen who do it as a kind of a thing that they love doing, through to these kind of organisations where there's just like racks and racks of these fish being breeded, and then they ship them off and that kind of thing. It's very much a business.
So it's more about, I suppose, a reaction to it as an art form rather than the ethics of actually doing it.
Well, she asks the questions you would hope to ask, but she never grills the people on it. It's quite a kind of neutral stance. It gets their opinion without kind of her placing judgment on them, and then you can make your own minds up. I mean, it also, as well as looking at the breeding environments that I mentioned, like the retired businessmen and so on, it also takes place when you go to the actual ceremonies where these fish are kind of engaged, almost like a crufts type scenario.
Crufts for fish.
Indeed.
Well, you heard it here first.
And it might be just worth describing these fish. So the Ranchu are a flat-headed orange fish, which derived from the carp, and it kind of started in the mid-1800s. Now, when kind of the upper classes used to have fish at that period, it was kind of considered quite a kind of refined thing to look at. And they didn't actually really have glassware as much then, so they were generally looking in porcelain bowls or that kind of thing. And you would only look at the fish directly from above. So these fish are not designed to be seen from the side, it's purely from above in a bowl. And that explains quite a lot about how they've been bred, because they have very plump trunks, very flat faces, and an absent dorsal fin, which is down to the deliberate breeding. They have an exaggerated silhouette, they have impeded movement, which raises ethical questions, but they are incredibly beautiful to look at from that angle.
And I'm guessing they're of high value in terms of they're something that's treasured and prized as we go through.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I heard a statistic which was if a breeder makes maybe 5,000 of them, 4,500 of them may get discarded and only 500 are kept.
Wow.
So, you know, they have to do an awful lot to get that exact look that they're after. And yeah, it's big business. It's big business, all right.
But how are these fancy fish displayed in the exhibition? How does that get across?
Okay, so you've got two pieces. You've got the documentary, which is 20 minutes, which is on a large screen. It's very lovelyly shot. You're bathed in this white light. You can really look at the subtle movements of the fish. There's some humorous elements in it as well.
Does it make you feel like a fish? Is that the idea?
I don't know about that, but it you can't help but marvel at the kind of beauty of these fish when you see them up at that scale and to that attention. And then there's a secondary piece which kind of recreates the act of looking at one of these bowls, and you've got a porcelain bowl that's about the size that they would be, and you've got water in it, and it's in a dark room, but you've got a projection from the ceiling pointing down at the bowl, and you can see two video projections of fish looking like they're moving around in the water. So without actually bringing some ranchu fish to Southampton, you can get the idea of what it might be like to look at these.
Dave, what's your experience of fish? From an artistic point of view.
No, I live about 100 yards from the fish market on the
Canal. Well, that's near enough.
They are very beautiful things, of course, aren't they? And I mean, it always strikes me that one of the things about them is that they are very beautiful living creatures who in some key senses are the complete antithesis of us. So that, you know, for example, we live in air, they live in water. We walk around. We walk around like bears walk around or dogs walk around, but fish move differently in a different medium. So there's already a kind of transformism. The thing that I'm not quite getting a hang on, and I have to say that I haven't been to this show. I've looked at the online thing, and Simon's brought some pictures and so on. I want to ask that, if you like, the man or woman in the street question.
Go on, you can ask that.
Why is it art? Why is this not a documentary film that's shown on Channel 4 or BBC 4, rather, at 9 o'clock on a Monday night?
We're not going to demand comment from the blackbirds that live in your garden again, are we, for regular listeners? Simon, why is it art?
Okay, so there's two pieces there. I think the first piece would count as installation. You know, it's a light projection and it's got a 3D element and the lighting is all part of it. I think the second piece is fair comment because it is essentially a very nicely shot documentary that's thought-provoking. You do get something from it at that scale, sitting in a room bathed in that light. I did feel very much that I wasn't watching a fine art piece of filmmaking. I was watching a very well-made documentary.
And to some extent, I think it's perfectly fine that something like the John Hansard Gallery might do that, because it is a university gallery. And I think this question of, there's an old debate about the separation of the arts and the sciences, and old debates about the reintegration of them and so on. And I'm fine with all of that, really. I'm just, in a sense, mindful of all the artists in the country queuing up, desperate for shows, not getting shows, not managing to get in anywhere, and suddenly seeing a documentary film like that was the purpose of my question. But I accept
that's an interesting, because this artist Revital Cohen, she does do documentaries, but she also does other things, and she's quite interested in this idea of designer species, and often her work combines biology and aesthetics and conceptual art and animal breeding. And she's done things, for example, where she's created a large play cage for rats, which would boost their serotonin levels. And whereas these rats are normally clinically depressed, she's trying to reverse their depressive tendencies. So she's kind of very much on the borderline between science and making an aesthetical statement. And I suppose a link you could make is maybe to an artist like Damien Hirst with his 1,000 Years piece, where you had the maggots forming on the dead cow's head. Mm. And then as soon as they kind of hatch, they go and get blitzed by an electric fly killer. And it's kind of like that playing around with, you know, and it does raise ethical questions, but it kind of blurs the lines between art and science.
I mean, the other thing that I'm sounding a bit like a grumpy old man. I'm certainly old, so maybe that's fair enough tonight. And I'm not greatly adverse to this, but I was interested to read the claim. It said it's the exhibition as a whole is concerned with historical and contemporary entanglements with nature, technology and the economy. And I was thinking to myself, Well, that's everything then.
Yeah.
You know, apart from God, that's everything. And you can't have a small exhibition in a small, you know, out-of-town art gallery that takes as its subject matter the entire history of the world.
Yeah.
You know, actually, they need to focus in a little bit and say...
It's quite ambitious, isn't it, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think when I read the blurb, it sounded like a really interesting exhibition, but it would be a great exhibition if it was like 10 rooms and they had a huge London gallery or a huge gallery anywhere to dedicate to this. When you've only got a few rooms and you've only got two artists as well, there's a lot of big claims that are made about the exhibition, but there's only two artists that can do this. It kind of felt to me like, okay, these two artists have started to explore this, but I want to see like another handful of artists, because it's such a big kind of thing it's starting to do. But what I would say is that the work of Revital Cohen, I don't think I'll forget, and this Culture of the Rancho Fish, I did find, as I say, both morally challenging and beguiling at the same time. And I'm glad that I've seen that work.
Your point about Crufts, I thought, was interesting, because that was, you know, I was thinking to myself, I mean, there's a fascinating thing about you have to look at it from above. And, you know, there is a sense in which at least traditional Japanese culture sometimes is very heavily rule-driven. So I, my inclination will always be, if I walk in somewhere and somebody says, you can only look at this from above, I'll immediately look at it from the side, you know, which is just because I'm a, you know, 60s rebel, aren't I, you know.
Subversive behaviour, you know, yeah.
But, you know, so that's kind of... But it did occur to me that actually... We just do, everybody's doing it all the time, you know, and sometimes we're producing super cows because we want to eat them, you know, and sometimes we're producing super poodles because we want to run around a stadium, and we do it. It's not, you know, it's not just the Japanese, and it's a very odd thing to do to animals in some senses.
I mean, I don't know if it was the artist or the curator, but somewhere along the line, I heard them describing these as biological products.
Yes.
You know, they're not food, they're not companions, they're not bred to be independent, they're certainly not efficient fish that could survive on their own, really. They're kind of like just aesthetic. There's this big push between the ethics for the animal and the ancient traditions of Japan, and like it's like what should go. And I think what's interesting is that the kind of traditions from the Edo period still are very much inherent within what they're aiming for within these aesthetics.
Do you know, I mean, I don't think I'd ever really thought this through, but I wonder whether anybody ever keeps fish with which they have a genuinely reciprocal relationship, you know. Now, I mean, my next door neighbours have a dog. It's quite clear to me that there is a relationship between the dog and the people that take it for walks and so on. And even, you know, my quirky blackbird point, it is a fact that my family of blackbirds sit in the garden in the morning and wait for me to come out and feed them. When I come out, they rush off. As soon as I've put the bird feed down, they're back. We have a relationship, you know. They send signals. I'm not sure that there are any pet fish that ever... Maybe I'm wrong, because I don't keep pet fish. Do pet fish... You don't have a reciprocal relationship with them. They are aesthetic objects, aren't they? You look at them
like
you look at an inanimate painting.
Yes, And I guess this is just a very heightened version of that, because it's so specific, the particular look they've got to have. And they have to go through all these kind of judging panels to kind of reach this kind of high level of aesthetics. And so many of them are discarded, so many are destroyed to get those few that are actually fitting in within that ideal.
And as if that's not crazy enough, the other artist, Melanie Jackson, I think, has a piece called The Erpflanzer, Part 2.
Indeed.
Which is based around the concept of an imaginary primal plant.
Yes, yeah. Now, this, what's worth mentioning is this room is very, very different. Whereas Revital Cohen's room is a very sort of minimal, very kind of calm. This one is aesthetically gross in parts. It's kind of messy, jarring, deliberately discordant. There's like slime and mud thrown up against the walls. There's kind of all this kind of deliberate stuff to make it a very convoluted room. Like you say, it's based on the idea of a concept which was came up by the German writer, artist and politician Johann Wolfgang von Gief.
German's your second language, isn't it?
when he's not talking Japanese.
Yeah, yeah. Well, why not?
And now he wrote on a variety of style in a variety of styles and a variety of subjects, including botany, anatomy, and science. And he came up with this concept of an archetypal primal plant, and the idea that it's this organism contains within it all previous plant forms, as well as the potential to generate all future ones. Okay, that's her starting point. There's also this idea that if you break down life forms to like almost like this liquid level, you kind of get to like the starting points of DNA and that kind of thing. So she starts to play with this kind of gloopy, primordial-looking clay, mud, oozy stuff. She looks at jellyfish, which are very close to kind of liquid in their form. She looks at liquid crystals, which I believe are, like, you know, known as a smart material. And she's kind of exploring this kind of idea that, like, how kind of mushed up does life get, and it still remains a kind of intelligence, or it still remains a kind of its own inherent DNA or something like that. But what I would say is intellectually challenging, but my goodness, it was a difficult room to work with.
Was it, you said you used the word gross, was it just sort of freak out gross, or was it kind of visceral buckets of things, or?
Well, I think on a couple of levels, like, there's a lot of kind of gloopy kind of stuff where she's looking at this primordial ooze. And then there's also, for example, some graphics which are on animations which are on videos. There's also a comic book. This is an artist who's definitely sort of multimedia. And this particular comic book, you know, the cover of it is very kind of garish.
Just to describe that a little bit, there's a carrot on the front cover of this comic book.
Yeah. And so sort of global hypercolour images about. It kind of feels to me like there was a trend in graphic design a few years ago called the New Ugly, which was pioneered by magazines like Super Super, where they deliberately broke away from the, you know, good taste rules. And that almost feels what she's doing, like she's deliberately being jarring and wanting to create something which isn't necessarily aesthetically easy on the eye.
Does this all work? Do the kind of bright fish and carrots and gloop and gross design, does it work as a... I know I always ask you that question about the exhibition, but, you know, does it make the point it sets out to?
For Revital Cohen's work, definitely. With Melanie Jackson's work, I felt that there's clearly something going on there, but I didn't feel that it was made accessible. She's clearly very involved in a process, and she's clearly trying out lots of things, whether it's a comic book, whether it's sculpture, whether it's video. She's clearly kind of thinking on a deeper level with her work, but whether it's clear to other people what she's thinking about is another matter. It felt almost like it was like a development stage of a project rather than the final thing. It felt like she was kind of going somewhere interesting with it, but she needs to make it clearer and more accessible to people. Maybe that's a bit of a Luddite thing to say, but I think I wasn't the only one at the exhibition that felt that way.
It sounds to me that you've just described it as being a process of transformation rather than an outcome or an end in itself.
Exactly, yeah.
Oh, an interesting layer.
I agree. Now, and there's an interesting quote by the curator, which is that she said about this particular Up Flansy piece by Melanie Jackson, as a curator, you think it's going to go one way, then it goes the other. And I'm reading into that maybe, but I wonder whether it was quite what they expected. I think they might have been expecting something more concrete at the end of this.
That's an endless challenge, isn't it, for artworks, really? Mm. The artworks, in a sense, are almost always works in progress, but at some point somebody says, OK, on April the 7th, you have to hang these pictures on the wall or whatever it is. Mm. And there's always, you know, at least in the modern world, I suppose it might have been different 200 years ago, that you worked to a, you know, the Royal Academy show and you had the thing. Although even then, you know, they tell famous stories about Turner at the show having hung the painting and be there with his paintbrushes still changing the damn thing on the wall. It's, you know, and it, I mean, that's, I think that's true of almost all art, really. Certainly true of playing music. You know, there's a point where you've got a gig. Okay, haven't quite rehearsed that number well enough. Yeah. Tough. Get on there and play it, you know.
If you fancy fabricated fish and a bit of gloop, you can go to the John Hansard Gallery in Southampton, where you can catch Transformism, Melanie Jackson and Revital Cohen's work, until the 9th of March 2013. We move now to music in the shape of the 6th studio album by Manchester three-piece I Am Clute, entitled Let It All In, which was released just at the end of January. The album's quite interesting because it's produced by Guy Garvey and Craig Potter of Elbow fame, who actually also have worked on their last album and worked on their very first album as well. It's been quite successful for I Am Clute. It's been in the fabulous top 10 UK albums chart, and it was also number one in the official record store chart. I didn't know such a thing existed. I should declare before we start discussing the album that I am a huge I Am Clute fan. We don't always just bring things that we know and love to the show, but I'm a huge I Am Clute fan. I've seen I Am Clute, I think, the most out of all the bands I've seen them probably about 5 or 6 times in various guises, and I think they're great. This album is quite different for them, I think. It's quite a challenge in some respects. It's been said about I Am Clute that they don't actually make albums, they just make songs and collect them together, and the albums are collections of songs. So there's no real kind of end aim in terms of a product or a theme as an album, that what they're really doing is collecting the songs together. They've had, in terms of their commercial success, they've had a few, I would say, near misses in terms of chart success. So at the moment, I think this stands as their most successful album to date. They've got a really interesting sound, I think. They managed to capture a number of different elements. It's very clear that they have a kind of northwestern, northwest England heritage that comes across. There are, I think it's fair to say, fairly obviously elements of the Beatles and our old friend Bob Dylan. I think they're some of their back catalogue, some of his back catalogue has been trawled over and for this album. But there are also, I think, things that strike me about this album which Tom Waits might be comfortable singing. You know, there's a real kind of bit of experimentation into some new things. Dave might argue with me here, but I think quintessentially what we're talking about here is blues. I think this is new blues. There's a kind of urban blues element to this. He's looking at me in horror now. My argument there starts from the bass, you know, that has a very sultry, slow, dark bass. But there's also a good dollop of kind of agony and longing about a lot of these songs. But both Simon and Dave, very interestingly, are quite new to I Am Clute, so I'm very keen to hear what you thought of the album. Let's start with you, Dave. You're looking worried.
Yes. You take my breath away.
Oh, there you go.
I mean, I've been listening passionately and obsessively to blues for 45 years, and it didn't strike me for 1 minute that this was a blues album.
Okay.
I'm sorry. One of the things that struck me about it, that it was melancholic. Not that it necessarily requires you to be melancholic, but it is in itself melancholic, which is not a bad thing. Joni Mitchell once made a very beautiful song in which she sang about comfort in melancholy, and there can be. But I found it melancholic in a similar way, and I am brand new to I Am Clute, in a similar way to Richard Hawley.
Okay, yeah.
And I have to say that most of the music I listen to needs somewhere to give me emotionally more of a lift. So the thing I always say about blues is that blues, generally speaking, sings about difficult, and not always, but difficult and unhappy and possibly melancholic situations. But what it actually does is lift you out of it. Okay, so the reason I didn't find this, it wasn't redolent of blues for me, is that it didn't lift me out of that melancholy. It took me into it, and I wasn't actually in the mood for it at that particular moment. That was my struggle with it, which is not that it's bad music, but that I didn't feel like being melancholic.
Simon, what about you?
Okay, well, my kind of understanding of the band up until this point is I've heard the odd song on compilations, and I've actually quite enjoyed them. I'm aware that John Peel supported them as well. There was a song, Marry Me, from 99, 2000, which I particularly liked. And I think I probably had them tapped wrong. I think I kind of... maybe it's the way they've been marketed, maybe it's their press photographs and that kind of thing, but I kind of had put them in that vein of, like, Embrace, Verve, those kind of bands, with, like, big anthems and that kind of thing. And actually, on listening to it, like, maybe they've got more in common with somebody like Badly Drawn Boy, or even going a gap further, somebody like Nick Drake, with this kind of more folky kind of sensitivity to the lyrics. I think for me, when they were trying to be a little bit more rocky, if that's the right word, I wasn't that interested. I found that it was a bit mid-tempo for my liking, and there wasn't really any tracks I felt that you would dance to or anything like that. They're very much like a songwriting band. But the bits that I really liked were the sensitive numbers. And I'd be quite happy to sort of... There's about three or four tracks on there which I would definitely want to listen to again and again. There's a track called Even the Stars. There's a track called Shoeless. And the lyrics I found were reflective, quite honest. They cause like a feeling of resignation and regret to them, quite tender. And I know what Dave's saying, like, about the blues being... you don't listen to the blues and necessarily feel more down yourself. But what I quite liked is it's like they were kind of voicing things that we all sometimes feel... And you don't feel as weird for feeling them yourself. a little bit like you get with the Smiths, you know? Like, they talk about people's sort of sensitivities and things they might not be comfortable unless they've had a few pints down the pub and they're with very, very close friends. It's those kind of topics that kind of come up. And some of the music and as well as... I know they're only a three-piece, but there's some orchestration and things like that on here, which is done very subtly and very nicely. I mean, I was listening to some of these tracks as driving to and from work late at night along the seafront. And it's very quiet, and there's the sea at night, and there's some, you know, lit up ships going by. And it was just the perfect setting for this kind of music. It's calm and it's reflective and slightly melancholy, like Dave says.
Now, you used a key word in what you just said. The key word for me is resignation. That, you know, that's something that really describes I Am Clute's sound, and I think really describes not all of this album, but two or three of the tracks on it. There's a, I think, an inevitability about some of their their work. You know, there is this kind of resigned to situations, to places, to kind of to reliving some of the kind of, I suppose, more somber moments in life, if you like. But I think it's sardonic. I think, and that links to what you said about the, you know, the Smiths, that there is a kind of, there's a wry sense of humour in all of this. Just reading through some of the kind of critics' reviews of the album, there's a quote from The Guardian, which is great, which says that, you know, this is full of mourning after moroseness, if moroseness is a word. But I think that helps to capture it. Well, one of the things that frames it for me is John Bramwell, the lead singer, his voice, his vocal is very genuine, very sharp. You know, it's very much, you know, it's not overproduced, it's not overtrained. There are real rough edges. And I think, you know, that's, for me, that's what makes the connection with some of this music. You're right to mention the sort of orchestral overload, I think, on some of the tracks. Hold Back the Night is probably the best example of that. And that's, I think, very much an Elbow influence. You know, Elbow had massive success applying that style and that kind of production technique to the Seldom Seen Kid, which was a huge album for them and, you know, kind of sealed the deal in many ways. It has a lot more polish than some of the other albums. It's not a very long album. It's quite a short album. But I think some of the songs, even though for me they are perhaps, some of them are a bit laboured, they do have real punch. You know, some of the lyrics have punch. Particular songs, you mentioned a couple. Hold Back the Night is one that the band have said defines I Am Clute as a band. You know, this is their defining track. This is our sound. This is what we want to be. And they say themselves that it's about a fear of the future. You know, that's kind of, this is all you've got. That's all you've got that's now.
I'm not hugely fond of this album, as you probably realise, but I do think he has a very distinctive voice. And if you were to like that voice, you would like it for its distinctiveness. And I can understand that. There's a thing that's occurring to me about it, which is, you know, I think I better reveal to the listeners, I'm 63. You know, I grew up with...
I'm shocked. It says in his contract, it's not a day over 40.
grew up in the period of the Beatles and so on and so on and so on. And there were two things that struck me. One was, I wasn't very surprised by it. And if I hear new music that I've never heard before, I want to hear something that says to me... And actually, Nick Drake was another one I heard in there, John Lennon and so on. And I need something more than that. There's another thing that occurs to me about their age, my age, your age, how you associate it with it. And I think, to be honest, that if you reach my age and you have a fairly cheerful outlook on life, which I do, you are nonetheless conscious that it would be very easy to slip into the melancholy of not having too much longer left. And I haven't got the time for it. You know, I'd really need to have a lot of pleasure in my life. It doesn't have to be superficial, silly fun, but I haven't got time for somebody, you know, to sit and listen to somebody making me melancholic for 40 minutes. I would rather get out on the seafront and just enjoy the air and the view and be cheerful and happy. So, you know, and that's not a criticism of that album. That's a comment about people at a certain age of a certain disposition, whether you can find your way into that kind of music or not.
They have been sort of labelled maybe unfairly as the grumpy man's Elbow, and like, or maybe the best band in Britain that never quite made it. And I do wonder, there is a time and a place for that kind of sensitive, kind of low key kind of mood, and I think they do that very well. And do they actually want to be huge? Are they quite happy with where they are? You know, with the kind of level of sales they've got.
Well, they're often, aren't they, described as a kind of underdog band? You know, as you said, you know, the kind of band that haven't quite made it. And I think of all the albums to date, as I said, you know, this is the one that's probably commercially you know, done most well for them.
Who's buying it then, do you think? I mean, I've characterised me as somebody who wouldn't buy it, but you clearly do, which we know about you, but more generally.
Well, it's an interesting question. I think, you know, it's definitely pitched at the kind of the indie market, let's call it that. But, you know, for me, I think it's about songwriting, and I think, you know, that the strength of it is about, it's not just kind of catchy beats and rhythms, it's actually about quality of lyric and depth of lyric. There's a really interesting track on the album called Masquerade, which it does really, to me, sound like a Beatles song. You know, it's very much, this could be on the Beatles back catalogue. And I have to say, I'm not a huge fan of the Beatles. You know, that's probably, you know, sacrilege. You know, we know my opinion on Bob Dylan. You know, the Beatles has gone on the list as well, which is, you know, I'm making friends by the minute. But it's really interesting that John Bramwell, the singer, said that he only really understood the process of songwriting and playing and, you know, kind of almost chord structure when he sat down to play this song. You know, and it kind of came together on this this album. So there is this kind of, you know, notion that they're constantly sort of forming their sound and the kind of formation mm-hmm. of things. And it's interesting, I think, some of the production values that you can quite clearly hear yeah. throughout this record, yeah. which aren't I Am Glutes. You know, it's very much an elbow yeah. sound. And I think actually Guy Garvey does do some backing vocals on a couple of the numbers.
I mean, I don't, you know, until a couple of years ago, I worked regularly with young university students, and they would tell me about stuff they bought. I don't do that anymore now, but I'm wondering, is it a student thing or is it older than student?
Well, it's interesting because I was looking at some reviews in preparation, and it was quite well received by the NME, and they do make the point that it's a bit of a kind of... A slightly grumpier, sort of slightly older album, but they did review it well, and it was kind of suggested that people would be interested in it.
And the other thing that Simon raised, which I also thought was, this is not always true, so this is an exaggeration, but I am fond of music that you can dance to, and you can't dance to this, and you can't dance to much of the other stuff that you reeled off, like Nick Kagan.
I try.
But it wouldn't be as much fun as dancing to Otis Redding, for instance.
It'd be fun watching me dance. Yeah. I would have thought,
But so, I mean, is it true that there is this increasing genre of music that isn't just, you know, acoustic singer-songwriter, but is nonetheless not dance music?
Yeah, I guess that is. Yeah. I mean, you know, the kind of another album I've been recently listening to is the David Byrne and St. Vincent album, which is very much music to dance to, you know, but equally it's kind of for people, for connoisseurs, if you like, of songwriting. You know, it's very articulate, very well-constructed. Pop.
I heard a quote about David Byrne and the Talking Heads, that they engage both the mind and the hips at the same time, which I think is, and I think, you know, this is probably one that the I Am Clute album is more just engaging the mind, isn't it? It's about the songwriting and the sonic pleasure. I can't imagine people dance when they go to an I Am Clute gig. It doesn't seem like that kind of music. It's more that you kind of let the sound wash over you and you listen out for the subtleties of the lyrics.
There's a very common introduction when you go to an I Am Clute gig, which I should urge you to do. There's a very common introduction from the lead singer. He always introduces songs saying, well, I can't completely repeat what he says, but one of the things he says is, this song is about drinking and disaster. You know, and pretty much the whole set is about drinking and disaster, which gives you a bit of a clue. On the vinyl version of the album, on the LP, I think they long player, they used to call them, didn't they?
They certainly did, yeah.
The poet Simon Armitage has a kind of a foreword, which is only in that format. And he says, there's something familiar and immediate about the sound they make, so much so that even a new song can find a place in the memory vault, even before it's finished playing, as if we'd been listening to it for years. I like that because there is, I think he's right, there is that kind of, we used the word resignation earlier on, but there is that familiarity about that music as well to me. Well, maybe because I've been to so many gigs and listened to so many records, but...
No, I think that's right. I mean, in a sense, that was one of my criticisms of it, that it didn't surprise me. And, you know, but that's okay. I mean, it's not the end of the world. I think he's right about that. There is a familiarity.
Let It All In is out now on the Shepherd Moon label by I Am Clute. And this track we're going to play is Bullets. It opens the album. You can also check out a sampler of the album on SoundCloud at the moment. We'll post a link on the blog. We move now to jazz. And Dave, you're going to take us gently by the hand through jazz.
Yes, I hope it's reasonably gentle. I mean, we've just had one or two discussions about other sorts of music, and I made a couple of interventions there where I talked about a certain definition of blues, which I think is more accessible than jazz, because there's a big question about what do we mean by jazz, because it covers an enormous range of sounds and styles and so on and so on. Attendant on that was the question about dancing, because there's no doubt that I think most people, when they think of jazz, think of something that has its roots in dance but may not be there all the time anymore. But what's brought this on is that this month there's been a drama on British television, on BBC, called Dancing on the Edge, about a fictional black and predominantly American band that turn up in London, get picked up by a journalist on a fictional newspaper, and begin to find some success. And, you know, they play to royalty. Now, a lot of the story is based on one or two true events that occurred. And it's quite instructive, really, I think, to... There's a chap called Hutch, Leslie Hutchinson, who played a great deal in Britain, was a big star. And we think that the main actor in Dancing on the Edge was based on him. But the other connection is with a band that people will know more familiarly, and that's the Duke Ellington Orchestra. And the Duke Ellington Orchestra came to Britain for the first time in 1933, and they followed on from a number of jazz acts that had come to Britain from America before that. The first one, we think, was probably the original Dixieland Jazz Band, which was actually, interestingly, a white band that came in 1919, immediately after the First World War, and got a kind of mixed reception, but on the whole, people liked them a great deal. And other bands of a lesser reputation came through the 20s. In 1926, The Melody Maker was published for the first time, and I'm realising that if you're under a certain age, The Melody Maker itself may not mean a great deal to you, but we were talking about that earlier, and you said, James, that it amalgamated eventually with the New Musical Express, the NME.
I think it got swallowed up, yeah, in a swirl of music.
But there's no doubt at all that in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, it was the weekly or monthly and then weekly newspaper to read, more than the NME, less poppy, much more broadly spread. So that I read it avidly as a teenager because it covered a lot of pop music. It had the charts in there, but it also covered blues, jazz, folk, all those kind of areas that were just on the edge of mainstream popular music, and covered all the live acts and live tours and so on and so on. So The Melody Maker starts in 1926, but it starts very oddly with a brutally racist editor who's simply abusive about black musicians in a way that, you know, we've agreed we can't, you know, read out on the air some of the things that he wrote. It is partly abusive on the basis that he's convinced that white bands of the time were superior to the black bands. And really the confusion that comes up in the 20s and 30s is between what's called dance bands and jazz bands. And there is a confusion there. And the British tradition was a tradition largely of dance bands, although a lot of musicians who wanted to be jazz musicians played in the dance bands to earn a living and then, you know, would improvise late at night and play jazz. But in the early 30s, two giant visitors come from America. Louis Armstrong comes first, and he has a bit of a mixed reception, but he's only playing as a soloist with a pickup band from Paris who are not very good. So on the whole, people recognise that he's a great performer and that his records begin to appear. But when Ellington comes in 1933, he simply knocks people dead. And his band are astonished by the fact that English and French audiences appear to be far more knowledgeable about the band and their recordings and their history. And there's one occasion early on when he plays a concert in London and he plays some of the poppier stuff that he usually plays in America. And he gets some slightly poor reviews, and people say, why is he doing this? Why didn't he play those longer orchestral pieces and so on, you know, those beautifully written composed pieces? And so he does. He puts on two more concerts and he plays this stuff, and people absolutely love him. So there is this really interesting transformation that's going on, which is then suddenly hit by the sheer stupidity of the Musicians' Union in Britain, who in the mid-1930s, in order to protect British music jobs, say nobody can come from America unless there's a reciprocal tour of a British band to America. And of course the problem is the Americans don't want to hear our second-rate dance bands. And so for 20 years you get hardly any major American stars come into this country. And that doesn't get repealed until the late 50s. And then suddenly people begin to turn up again. And I had the enormous good fortune in the 60s of seeing all kinds of jazz musicians. I saw Miles Davis, and I saw, he was pretty old by then, but I saw Duke Ellington at Portsmouth Guildhall. I mean, it was, and you know, I was 16, and it was just one of those life-changing experiences, really. And I mean, I am a huge jazz fan now. So, I mean, to return to Dancing on the Edge, and then I'll let you guys get in. I mean, I was greatly entertained by it. But I was going to just, you know, kind of throw up a number of contradictions. There's a gender contradiction. There's a male-female thing, because it's predominantly about, you know, men playing in bands and the girls, you know, they get to sing or they get to take the photographs, but they're not actually central. And that was one of the things. There's a huge class issue, which is not just upper class, lower class, whatever, you know, there's upper class, middle class, professional musicians, what are they? And royalty, absolutely true that you know, the two kings of the late 30s, the abdicating king and then George, you know, with the stammer and so on, both big jazz fans, you know, and there are stories about them going to, not just to meet the Duke Ellington band, but actually Edward sits in. He plays drums at one point, with the Ellington. Not, I don't think it was a major performance, but he actually gets to play with them and so on. They really did actually, love jazz, and that helped enormously.
I can imagine that kind of thing going on today with some of the incumbents, I'm sure.
I guess Harry could probably sit in with I Am Clute or something.
He'd give it a go, wouldn't he? Yeah. Coming back to Dancing on the Edge, which is a Stephen Polyakov drama.
Yeah.
For me, there's a number of questions that kind of threw themselves at me when I was watching it. The look of it, I was really interested in how it looked and how it kind of played out in terms of, it was almost like a graphic novel.
Yeah.
In the sense that the first, first 5 or 10 minutes of the programme, you sit there and watch it, the first opening sequence has Louis Lester, which is played by Chiwetel Ejiofor, walking through the streets dressed in a cane and a top hat and all that kind of thing, almost like Jack the Ripper, like a kind of menacing, deadly figure running from the scene of a crime, which we kind of find out initially he is, and then a number of things kind of roll out throughout the story.
Yeah.
So when you first watch it, you think, oh, I thought this was about jazz and about, the music scene. The pace and the speed of the drama. I read a number of things. Polyakov, I think, has always been criticised about doing stuff far too slow. And then when people criticise him for doing things far too slow, he slows it down a bit. There's too much action in it. I think that's probably his response. So that's quite interesting. Yeah. So it's not initially the paciest thing to watch, but it does grow on you. It's very deep. It's very kind of rich in terms of its subject. I was staggered to learn that the BBC commissioned this with a budget of £8.3 million. That's a huge budget.
It is a huge budget. It's a lot more than they spent on jazz in the first 3 decades, I'll tell you that. I didn't know that. The production values are considerable, aren't they, really? And that is one of the features of it, that is a fairly new phenomenon in television. And I applaud that. Now, I think there's always a danger that producers and writers will respond too willingly to that and perhaps, as you say, slowed things down or make them too lavish or whatever. On the other hand, it is interesting that this was a band that was dragging themselves out of the kind of seedier cellar clubs, which has always been one of the natural locations for jazz. I mean, think Ronnie Scott's, for instance, which started absolutely, downstairs in something that had been a taxi waiting room. That's where Ronnie Scott started in 59, And it started as a place just for the musicians to play and entertain themselves, really. But they drag themselves out of that and end up in, lavish surroundings. And when Ellington comes to England in 1933, he's put up at the Dorchester Hotel and loved the Dorchester so much he always went back there when he came back to England afterwards. So, there were those two levels. I think after the war in particular, jazz gets returned to the basements and the cellars and becomes much more a bohemian thing, much kind of lower key thing and hipper in a certain kind of way as a consequence.
I wondered from a number of things that you said, just to start with, how authentic this drama was in terms of initially how authentic the premise of it is. And I think actually you've answered that already. It's very authentic in terms of based on a number of things that happened. That one of the lead characters writes for the Musical Express, I think it's called in the in the drama, rather than Melody Maker. But the inference is it's the same guy. The music, I'm interested to ask you about that because I'm not sure how authentic the music is.
I was indifferent to the music, to be honest. It's an original score and it seemed to me too contemporary and too poppy, frankly. If it's going to be contemporary, it's got to take account of what's happened in jazz in the last 50 years, which is an awful lot of far more experimental stuff than that. It's not going to be contemporary. I don't see why they didn't go to the stuff that was actually written and played at the time. So although I thought it was performed very well, and there are some notable musicians, I mean Steve Williamson, who was at one time vying with Courtney Pine as the bright new star of he's in it, English jazz, and the singers sing beautifully, but it was, I don't know, I mean, let's get Simon to talk about the music if he wants to a bit, but
he's itching to dance too, I think that's
too,
what it is.
You could dance to it without any doubt, that worked, but it was too poppy for me.
So what do you make of it?
I mean, there's not any tracks that stick out in my memory. I think, like yourselves, I think I was charmed by the drama, and I did sort of get the sense that it did seem quite plausible, but at the same time, it was very quintessentially Polyakov. He's got a very kind of trademark style, and he's a TV program maker who kind of infuriates and fascinates me at the same time, because, you know, I find myself thinking, okay, I think I've seen this before. There's an eccentric millionaire. Yeah. There's the working class kind of hero or lower middle class hero coming into an eccentric bunch of upper class people and the class issues that come there. Quite often it's a working class guy or a lower middle class guy and an upper class girl. That seems to happen quite a lot in his dramas. There's often a thing about the culture and the arts colliding with authority such as businesses and bureaucracy and the government, and that's happened in a lot of his dramas before. And they always seem to have, the millionaire always seems to put on some big outdoor bash in a garden. That happens in every Polyakov drama without fail. But it is also engaging, you know. You're charmed by how the other half lives. It's fascinating to see some of their, you know, decadent ways. You've got some top actors in here. You know, almost every couple of scenes, a new face is pulled out. And you're like, oh, wow, he's in it as well. She's in it as well. And the sets and the cinematography are just lush, you know, and all the costumes are spot on. So it's to be marvelled at from that respect.
Certainly for me, I haven't seen all of it. You know, certainly the first episode for me was quite clunky in some places in terms of, you know, they were almost what I would call the Scooby-Doo moment, you know, where you kind of, you twig that, you know, the janitor is actually the monster, that kind of thing, where there are these huge arrows, like, here is a big evil billionaire, millionaire man who's going to do you wrong. Here is a room with a scene where something bad has happened. This is a fit-up flashing, you know, neon kind of arrows. Troubled me a little bit, because I found some of it quite predictable.
Clunky is a word that definitely came up a few times. There was a bit where they're in a dark room, and one of the upper-class characters is showing one of the musicians, you know, how the photographic process works. He's never been in a dark room before. And they go, oh, and he goes, who's that? She goes, oh, that's this eccentric millionaire who we might happen to meet later in episode 2.
Yes.
And it was just, oh, my goodness, I can't believe it. £8 million and they can fit that in the script, you know.
There's hope for us yet, isn't there? So with Dancing on the Edge, you've mentioned, obviously, it kind of portrays the kind of class and the race issues at that time. Do you think it does that accurately enough, or do you think it distorts some of that?
Well, I think ultimately, of course, the question about race, class and gender in all of those things is that we can never know about its accuracy. And, you know, we've alluded to the fact that there were some really, really nasty things written in quite mainstream music about black people, for example. And they don't replicate that in the programme. And I think I'm glad that they don't. And I don't think we need to hear that kind of thing. In the end, the challenge for us always with those kinds of questions is to say, now, what's that telling you about today? It's not actually about 1933, because we don't need to know what happened in 1933. You know, what we need to know is, do we behave decently to other human beings? And, you know, sometimes, you know, it's useful to address those issues in something that's not just contemporary and in your face, you know. So did I think that helps? I don't know, really. I mean, I'm a classic, you know, academic liberal 63-year-old who thinks he's got all the right attitude, so I don't know, you know, whether I need transforming by that stuff. I probably do, but, you know, did it change me in any way? I'm not sure, you know, but I think that's always the challenge. Let's put this
together. Just before we go, we've just got time to catch up with a few events around and about Portsmouth. On the 28th of Feb, if you fancy going for a bit of wonder stuff, you can find Miles Hunt and Erica Knuckles in an acoustic session at the Cellars at Eastney.
I've got Cellars events as well. They're clearly the place to be, and the Cellars are rather nice because they've been revamped. On the 1st of March, which is a Friday, there's a youngish blues player who's been around Britain for quite a long time now, playing a solo set, not bringing his band, a solo set. His name's Ainsley Lister. And then one of the granddaddies of British rhythm and blues, the kind of contemporaries of the Rolling Stones. And this is really April, but it's only the 2nd of April, so I think I'll give this a mention. Also at the Cellars, the Pretty Things.
OK, I've also got a music selection here. Willie Mason is playing at the Wedge of Dreams on Sunday the 3rd. He's originally a young folk singer from Martha's Vineyard who came to fame for kind of mixing hungry young man type lyrics, social political messages, in a work that kind of echoes Dylan, Cash or Guthrie. That's Willie Mason, Sunday the 3rd.
Excellent. And if you fancy drinking strange substances and disappearing down holes with rabbits, you can catch Alice in Wonderland, the Disney classic, at the King's Theatre on the 10th of March. Certificate U. My thanks to Simon Mobbs and Dave Allen. I've been James Sandy, and this has been Towards the Point. Towards the Point is a King of the Buttons production for 93.7 Express FM.